Hey there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, the podcast all about why being alive is more interesting than people think it is. My name is Alex Schmidt, and I'm the head of podcasting here at Cracked. I am also known as Schmitty the Clam, and I am also rooting for America's struggling, downtrodden millionaires. Rooting for you guys who make over $1 million per year or possess millions of dollars. I found out this week that those people think they are having a hard time. There's a piece from The New Yorker that we will link to in the footnotes and is called The Psychology of Inequality. And while examining many, many poor people in the country, they also speak to some of the rich. Some of them are right there in New York. And here's what they have to say about themselves. Quote, "I feel like no matter what you have, somebody has about 100 times that." End quote. That is someone who has an apartment overlooking the Hudson River, a second home in the Hamptons, and a household income of at least $2 million per year. Here's another struggling person. Quote, "I mean, there are all the bankers that are heads and heels, you know, way above us." And this person also has over $2 million in income per year. And then here's a third person who objects to being called affluent. Quote, "Affluent is relative. Some friends of ours recently flew off on vacation on a private plane. That's affluence." End quote. And I don't mean to just dunk on these people. I think it's fascinating to find out that people who are making money that to many of us would be incredible wealth, to them, they're still struggling in their heads, in their mindset. There is still a difficulty that they're up against. Today's show is about everybody else in America. And I think it's worth noting that we, a few weeks back, got to have Charles C. Mann as a guest, who's an amazing author. He wrote the book 1491. He wrote his recent book, The Wizard and the Prophet. And he's taking a long view of history and what people have had. And one thing he found is that if you look at fossil fuels, they fundamentally changed the wealth of the average person. And anyone who lives in a home that is heated is weirdly kind of better off than even the richest people of the past, pre-around 1800. And I mean like kings, presidents. According to UC Davis historian Gregory Clark, things were totally different pre-fossil fuels. For example, Thomas Jefferson, who had a mansion at Monticello, also had a mansion that was 12 degrees Fahrenheit indoors in the winter, just because it didn't have central heating. And it was so cold that his ink would freeze when he tried to write with it. Even when you look at the Palace of Versailles, where all these fantastical French kings had beautiful dinners, the water glasses at those dinners would ice over if nobody touched them for a few minutes, because it was so cold inside that building. So today, if you have a home and if it has heating, you're richer than basically all of your ancestors if you go 5-6 generations back or more. And yet, we all know poverty is a real thing. We all know being poor is not a positive thing to go through, which raises the question of today's episode. Why in America are we so mean to our poorer people? We're going to talk all about this with my amazing guests today. It is a privilege to get to talk to both of these guys, especially together. One of them is Jason Pargin. He writes for Cracked as David Wong. And the other one goes by John Cheese. Jason and John grew up together. They had been friends for decades. It's just rare to get to hear a podcast where people go back that far. And it really comes through. I had the best time with them. They are two of my favorite writers and speakers when it comes to being a poorer person in America and what that experience is like. And they have found a particularly fascinating phenomenon going on in our country where we look at the poor and we don't say, it's good that some of them have a place to live and central heating. We say that stuff is making their lives too easy. And so schools and towns and the federal government will do objectively cruel things to our poor people just to do it. And I don't know if you realize this, but our society and our laws are made by people. We're doing this to our own poor. And today's episode is all about why that is, the psychology of that, the decision making behind that, and how maybe we can find a way to make life better for everybody in the country. I love this topic. I'm so glad we got to talk about it. And there's also a lot more you can read about it. This is a really rich footnotes section because we've got the work of Jason and John linked there. Also, you can find John these days over at his site, themodernrogue.com. They're doing just fantastic work, and I'm so happy for all of them putting that together, and we highly recommend you check that out. In the meantime, why don't we podcast all about it? Please sit back, or you know what? Yeah, sit back, enjoy it. I'm not going to judge you for being comfy. We all like being comfy sometimes. Quit being mean to poor people, America. Either way, enjoy this episode of the Cracked Podcast with Jason Pargin and John Cheese. I'll be back after we wrap up. Talk to you then. We are joined on the phone by executive editor of Cracked and longtime friend and appearer on the show, Jason Pargin, who writes for the site as David Wong. Hello, Jason. How you doing?
Hello, and that is the first time you have ever referred to me as your friend. That means a lot to me, and now I want to do the entire episode about that.
And we are also joined by a longtime friend of the site and writer here, and he's now the editor-in-chief at themodernrogue.com, and we're so happy he was gracious and took the time and came on. Please welcome John Cheese. Hello, John. Hey.
It's also the first time you've done the friend thing with me, and I'm quite frankly a little offended about it.
It's great to have you both on, and this episode, I think we're going to cover a lot of different things about kind of how poverty in America works, and in particular, how we treat each other when we become poor or have been poor. The spark to it was a news story that was everywhere last month, and it was from a Trump administration proposal that hasn't happened, as far as we can tell. But why don't we get into what that was, what they wanted to do?
First of all, I don't know if the listeners realize that a lot of the laws that are passed are not actually passed with the intention of solving a problem, or even necessarily ones that are proposed or even necessarily intended to go into effect. Lots of laws that are suggested or publicized, it's done purely to send a message to everyone else. For example, if I show up at Alex's house for a party, and he stops me at the door and says, hey, I'm going to do an impression of Alex's voice.
Yeah, sure, go for it.
He says, hey, in this house, you don't rub your dick on the television. I'm going to come to a conclusion that either A, Alex has heard something about me, or B, this has been a problem in the past, because the rule in itself is a sound, that's a solid rule to have for your house. But it's strangely specific, and it sends a message to me or to people listening nearby that he's almost insulting me by saying, hey, if I don't make a rule otherwise, I know for a fact this guy's going to rub his dick on my expensive television. So the law that they had suggested, or the change in policy that they suggested, was replacing about half of food stamp benefits with a box of non-perishable food, like canned goods or something. We can get into detail, and maybe we will, about why this is a horrible idea. But the idea, the main impetus behind this proposal was to send a message to everyone else, hey, if we just give poor people money, they're going to waste it. So we need to instead give them food to make sure that it's actually going toward food. Otherwise, the food stamps, they'll spend it on whatever, meth or junk food or whatever. So this is what triggered the conversation today, because there's actually a lot of laws like this where it's about kind of micromanaging the poor in a very dickish way.
Yeah.
But it's usually not to solve a specific problem. It's to imply to the rest of the populace and the voting population that the poor are wasting the help we give them and are likely to waste future help we give them.
Yeah, and you see the cognitive phenomenon a lot. There's a scientist named George Lakoff who has done a lot of work about it, and his trope is the phrase, don't think of an elephant. Which is, if you tell someone not to think about an elephant, it's very, very hard not to think about elephants. And so this is happening with laws people are pitching. They're like, we are finally doing the law where poor people won't spend their food stamps on like wedding cakes or whatever they're claiming there. And it's like, oh, poor people were spending their food stamps on wedding cakes, I guess, is what they think the public will then say. They don't really have any intention of passing this law that it was mentioned in public in
on Monday, February 12th of this year. It came out the next day, Tuesday, February 13th, that two different administration officials told the New York Times that, no, this was just all posturing because the administration wanted to cut $85 billion in food assistance programs. And this was one suggested way of doing it, which is let's replace food stamps with boxes of responsible, let's say, canned goods, when it's actually just posturing and all stuff to mess with people's heads.
Right. So when they make those statements like Jason was talking about, so here's a law or an idea that we're going to propose, but in reality, we're just making a political statement that addresses this issue, right? So one of the reasons it pisses people off so much is because that statement comes across in two different ways. One, it's poor people are too stupid to manage their own stuff, so we need to do it for them. Otherwise, they're going to destroy everything. And two, there's kind of this underlying statement. It's not even underlying. A lot of them just outright say it. They say things like, well, if you're going to be on welfare, if you're going to be on food stamps, you are entitled to work. So what we need to do is these poor people need to get off their asses and work. And meanwhile, the poor people are saying, yeah, that's what we're trying to do. The majority of us are not choosing to sit on our couch and bring in just enough money to survive. That's not like a life choice that a lot of us have. And so I don't know. It seems just like the statement is the same thing that the poor people already believe. It's like, hell yes, get us work. That's what we've been looking for, and we're not finding it, which is why we're on this shit to begin with.
Right. The unspoken statement is that the jobs are out there if they wanted them. It's sort of the same thing when you pass the, like, a homeless person. It's like, hey, that guy could go flip burgers if he wanted. Like, it's the assumption that there are always at least entry-level work out there, which is not true. It's you know, it depends on the economy. It certainly depends on where you are. But if you have no mobility and no ability to move or to do a lot of things, like if you don't have a phone where you can be contacted, even entry-level stuff can be beyond you. But another example of this that came up in the last few years was the states that made a big, big deal about drug testing for welfare recipients. And, you know, there's a lot of data now. This does nothing to lessen the rates of drug abuse. It does nothing to save the state money. What it does do is it sends that message that they really need to send, which is that the poor are having a big party. They're taking your hard-earned tax money and they're doing drugs with it. So you pass the law, and it's hard to argue against the law. It's like, well, gosh, you know, why shouldn't you have a rule against rubbing your dick on the television? That's bad for the TV. It says right in the manual. But it's like, yeah, but you specifically, you're not actually worried about that. Because if you follow up with, okay, do you think that drug abuse is rampant among lower income people? And therefore, do you want to fund a bunch of community rehab programs for free? Then the answer is, oh, hells no. We want to punish them into becoming clean. We want to hurt them until their addiction goes away.
Well, I had written the article for Cracked several years ago about how politicians will never truly understand the poor. And I had done some research into the mandatory drug testing for welfare recipients. And I don't remember if it was Arizona or Florida. Both states took part in it. And they had tested, we'll say, 21,000 people. And they found one person who failed the drug test. It cost them something like $46,000 to do that. But that one person that they stopped, I guess was worth it.
How many people could $46,000 have fed? Five people? Six? Come on, it's drop in the bucket. Couldn't have helped at all. It's amazing that it's a range of states and also areas of life where different legislators are saying what we need to do with laws and with our resources is take the poor and, like, punish them, retrain them, like, cordon them off and make sure they know that they are being poor people and they need to stop having these habits that I guess we're just assuming most poor people have when it's actually not true.
Well, and you go a step further in we do it too when we think about people like politicians bagging on the poor and all that, which is a simplistic way to say it. We always think of adults who are unmotivated and they can't get out and take care of themselves, or they're just being lazy. But there's a whole sect of the school system that shames poor kids who don't have anything to do with that income whatsoever. I think Jason was the one who found the stats for this, but there's something like, what, Jason, 40% of schools have a program in place to literally publicly shame the kids on free lunches?
Yeah, it's almost half. In America, it's almost half the school districts have some sort of a policy for basically, it's intended to separate the kids and somehow like make them feel bad in front of their peers or embarrass them somehow by design for taking the free lunch program.
I never really thought about it until you pointed it out. But when I was in middle school, we're talking 6th, 7th, 8th grade, I was on the free lunch program. And in order to get that, you have to show up at a specific office in the school at a specific time. There's like a 1 hour window where you can get your lunch ticket. And when you go in there, everybody knows why you're there. It's you're going in to get your free lunch ticket. And if you miss that window, you can't get it until lunchtime. You have to go back to the office and it's a big hassle. But once you're in line, like even if you've already got your lunch ticket, if you're in line waiting to get lunch, they would call you out and say, everybody with a free lunch pass, get out of line and go to the back of the line. And they did that with everybody. So we got trained to where if we didn't want to get called out in public, we had to just wait for everybody to pass and then purposely get in the back of the line. If you got up to the lunch counter and presented your free lunch pass and they realized you're up there too soon, they would take your tray back and tell you to get to the very back of the line, and then you'd have to go through it again. I never, ever thought about how humiliating that was until I got into high school, and we had an open campus. It was a small town, so you could just walk wherever you wanted for lunch. Once I got into high school, I never entered the cafeteria for all 4 years. Never ate one meal at lunch. I just sat outside and, you know, smoked cigarettes or whatever, hung out with my friends. But I never ate lunch beyond, if I had a few extra bucks, I'd go get a bag of chips or something. But it was so humiliating, I just stopped eating freaking lunch.
Yeah, the New York Times story that I found that talked about this from last year, there was one school where they, if the kid was behind on their lunch, their payment account, they would make a demonstration of throwing the food in the trash in front of the kid. Like, instead of giving it to someone else. This episode is not about the policy. This episode is about this concept that being poor is not punishment enough, that we have to be dicks to the poor to show them that being poor is wrong, because otherwise how would they know? Like, how would you have known that poverty is bad if the school didn't tell you, other than the fact that your house was cold in the winter?
Especially like delivering those punishments directly on children, when I feel like most of us are like, hey, the kids don't have agency to go ahead and make some money or something and try to fix it. Like, even less agency than a poor adult, you know? John, in one of your columns, you picked out that our old friend Newt Gingrich in the world of politics proposed something that has since come up quite a bit, which is, why don't we just have the poor kids be janitors? Right? They can be the janitor of their own school, like at night and stuff. And then they'll finally put in some work and make some money, you know? And that is a policy that is weirdly popular consistently, keeps coming up.
Well, his reasoning behind that is what bothered me, is that his reasoning was that these kids grow up in these poor households and they've never seen a day's work. Like, they've never seen their parents or older siblings work. And so they have no idea of what work is like. They have no work ethic because they've never experienced it. But when we did the research, we found out that somewhere in the mid 80s, like an 81 to an 85% of poor households have somebody working there. So the entire sentiment behind it is just horseshit. Like, right, they've seen work. They've seen parents work. It's we found the other stat that was 91% of people on welfare are children, the elderly, the disabled, and people who actually come from working households. 91%. And so the whole sentiment behind the lazy, poor person who greedily rubs their hands together and just exists on that sweet, sweet government funding, like, that's, it's not a thing. There are people who do that. Like, I'll never deny that they're, you know, I've met people who have purposely not gotten a job because getting a job means also getting a babysitter and the gas to and from the job and all the little daily expenditures that you have to have actually outweighed the welfare. I have met those people before in the past who it was more beneficial to stay on welfare than to get a job, depending on what type of job you get. Getting a 20-hour per week job at, you know, Dairy Queen, in some cases back then, you would lose money. Right. But that is not the freaking norm, and that's the way they present it. As, see, this is the way it is. You give them free money, and they'll just sit there and take it for the rest of their lives. And most of the people that I've known have been more like, get me the hell out of this situation. I will work whatever you want me to work so I don't have to deal with this crap anymore.
Yeah. And also, and that phrase you used that gets used in culture of like, ah, they'll just sit around and take the money. Like, I feel like that gets used against some people who like can't walk or something. You know, like there's also people who, right. I think one of you picked out some recent story about the Trump administration changing rules to allow states to impose work requirements on Medicaid recipients. So as people who need benefits and are maybe ill or injured or something like that, and we're like, ah, that lazy so-and-so.
To be fair, that policy about Medicaid did only apply to able-bodied recipients. That's an important point because the assumption is if you're not in a wheelchair, you should be able to get work. And I think that this, to me, speaks volumes about where you happen to be from. Because the idea of living in a place that is like a job desert, where you're like physically removed from other towns that actually have jobs to the point where the commute would be impossible or economically impossible, the idea that you could be able-bodied but be in a trap where you just can't find anything, or you, for whatever reason, you have things that keep you from working that don't necessarily count as disabilities, that's part of this. Because the assumption is that there's never a set of circumstances that could put you in that spot for long stretches of time. It's always the assumption that the system works. If you work hard, you'll succeed. Therefore, if you didn't succeed, that means you didn't work hard. Period. End of discussion. We have a culture in which we kind of shamed people out of manual labor, which is true. Yeah. You know, we make fun of it in movies. We laugh at somebody. You know, if somebody is a grown up and has to wear a ridiculous fast food outfit, we laugh at that person. And yeah, we've built it into the culture that it's shameful to have a low wage job. For this same thing we're talking about today, because it's like, no, it's not bad enough that you have to work that job. You need social pressure. You need all of society being dicks to you to motivate you to not do that job anymore. Because the fact that it pays $4 an hour, that's not enough to convince you.
I can't speak for bigger cities because I don't know how this works there. But in small towns, there's a weird paradox that goes on. So one, you can't have just a full-time job in a small town. They hardly exist. They get taken up very, very quickly because there are very, very few businesses. So you have to have two part-time jobs because most of the jobs around here will pay you for 20 to 28 hours worth of work in order to avoid having to give you insurance or benefits at all, vacation time, sick days, anything like that. So anyway, let's say you don't have a job for 6 months. You're not just sitting on your ass, you're applying. In a town like mine, I could leave today and get an application for every single business in town in a day and have all those filled out and turned back in tomorrow. Once you run out of those, there's nowhere to go, but you don't have a job, so you can't go to the next town over. Like, all of our towns are 30 minutes drive apart. Which in the city means a couple blocks down. Here, it means 30 miles away. So you spend 6 months looking for a job in a place that has no jobs. You don't have the funds to go to the next town over in order to get a job there. When you finally land an interview half a year later, the person interviewing you looks at your application and says, you've got a 6-month gap in your employment history, and all the red flags go up. Now it just looks like you're lazy. So you have to explain to them about why you didn't have a job in the first place. And if you're crafty enough, you can kind of worm your way into a job. It's going to be low paying. You're not going to get like a job at the bank or anything like that. We're talking about gas station jobs or grocery store cashier. You might be able to worm your way into it, but now you're stuck in that 20 hours per week job with no benefits, which means you have to do that again for your second job. Once you have both of those jobs going, you may be working 50, 60 hours a week between the two, but getting no overtime and no benefits. So you're banking two part-time jobs at normal, crappy pay. Then once you've got all that set up for your basic survival, now you have to make a decision. Do I stay here and continue working these two, maybe three jobs in order to survive? Or do I finally bank up enough money to move to a bigger place so that I can get a better job? And if you decide to do that, you have to save your ass off, because once you get to that new city, you start the entire freaking search over again to go to the next step. And that can take years. In fact, in a lot of places around where I live, it doesn't happen at all. Once you're here and you're in that weird sort of job paradox, you're stuck there forever.
Yeah. I feel like also our culture doesn't warn anyone about that. And we'll probably talk a bit about how we're just educated, but also in pop culture, especially in a sitcom, like you see a character hatch some kind of financial scheme or like some kind of business they're going to start, and then it doesn't work. But then by the next episode, the next week, they're fine again. But like these decisions you're talking about, John, like it's something that, like you say, it takes months or years. Like somebody's like, oh, I need to consider the dice roll of quitting my two jobs that aren't working for me financially to take on another chance at one in a new city. And the ramifications are enormous. It's a thing that people really have to figure out.
There's also the sort of Tetris game you have to play with your time, because remember, the odds of finding this job that works from 8 to 3 and then this job that works from 4 to 10 is extremely slim. Nobody works on the same shift schedules, right? Like you're trying to find a restaurant where you only work the dinner shift to be a server, and then you're trying to find a coffee shop, retail, something where they only need you during the day. If you are unavailable to take extra shifts, if you're inflexible about what shifts you can take, they're going to fire you. They're going to favor somebody who can be there at any time. If you continually say, no, I can't take Saturday overtime, I'm working at the restaurant, I'm working at the bar, they're just going to give more and more hours. Because when I say fire you, they don't even have to do it. All they have to do is just drop your hours down to nothing until you quit. Because right. See, that's the thing. One week you may get 12 hours, the next week you may get 36. But if you continually turn them down because you're inflexible, that means you're a bad employee, and therefore they'll just keep cutting and cutting and cutting your hours. And I get that the owners and the managers of the business, to them, this is just an annoyance because they need you and you're not around. But that's why those jobs, you know, they favor someone who is like a high school kid or a college kid. Because if somebody who's still living at home and they're not depending on that money, that's a better employee because their schedule is more flexible. Where someone like a single mom who has to be home for when the kid gets off school or whatever, that's to them is just a bad, annoying employee because, well, she's constantly missing work because her kid's always sick or her kid's got to be taken to school or the babysitter called in and therefore she has to stay home. So there's yet another place where the people who need the work the most are the ones that in many cases are least likely to get it.
It seems like with this kind of staffing thing, it also connects with this larger thing of how we treat people who need welfare or people who need benefits to stay alive, because it all feels like there's some kind of trust gap there or an understanding gap, or we either aren't bothering or aren't choosing to get to know the people involved, like just actually find out what they need or what they're capable of doing, and then catering to them in some way, shaping policies and jobs to fit what they're doing. It seems like as a country, we're generally unwilling to do that with poor people, or maybe just people. Maybe it only just acutely affects poor people.
It's that matter of perspective. I think it all goes down to that. Part of it's political manipulation in order to make a point. I understand that. But another part of it is the people who say, oh, your back hurts? Well, that's nothing. You know, I broke my arm 3 weeks ago and I had no problem dealing with the pain. They compare it to the way they live as if you're mirror images of each other, that you've got the same access to time, that you've got the same access to transportation. And here's what I would do if I were in your situation, because I know how I live. Therefore, you must be able to do the same thing. That perspective is one of the most toxic, dumb perspectives I've ever heard. But you see it everywhere. So if you get a politician who says, well, I don't understand why you can't just go to the doctor and get a checkup. I go once every 2 weeks. I have no problem doing it. It's hard to explain to them that, yes, you make 1,000 times more money than I do, and you also can set your own schedule, and you don't have to bring in a note from the doctor every time you do that to prove that you weren't just ditching work. That as far as a general population goes, there's a lot of people who do look at the poor by comparing them to how they live their own lives and make a judgment call off of that.
But that brings up a curious thing, because I think it would be easy to assume that this is purely a class warfare thing, that this is the rich hating the poor, the middle class hating the poor. And in polling, weirdly enough, it's other poor people who are the hardest on the poor. We had a poll from the LA Times talking about this, and that low-income people they're more likely to say that the poor are on welfare because they prefer it to work. They're more likely to say that government assistance has, you know, actually made the problem worse. And that is part of kind of the paradox of the Trump phenomenon, right? Because the whole narrative is that he, you know, rode into office on a wave of like low education, low income white people in coal country and, you know, in Pennsylvania and Michigan, all these places. And that those are the ones who were voting for the guy who then turned around and said, yeah, the poor should get just a box of canned goods instead of money.
Right.
And there's a related phenomenon, which is that among Americans, you're far more likely to get negative views of the poor from Christians than other groups. 46% of Christians say, this is in a Washington Post article, had the polling in there, 46% of Christians say that a lack of effort is generally to blame for somebody's poverty. Among non-Christians, that's only about 30%, 29%. So it's like almost twice as high. Among evangelical Christians, among white evangelical Christians, 53% say basically the poor are just poor because they're lazy. So when I say that it's other people in poverty, you know, you have high rates of like evangelical Christians. That's very big in these poor communities. And among those low-income people, you have some of the most bitter anti-poverty sentiment you'll find anywhere. Whereas among rich people, you at least have a lot of well-to-do liberals who kind of treat poor people like sad animals that they should adopt. they would never go to those communities, but they at least have like a childlike empathy with like, oh, these poor souls. John, was that your experience growing up in a town that had no shortage of like other people who were also struggling, but also had like no sympathy?
Yeah. And I can tell you how that mindset starts. When I was growing up in my original hometown, which I don't live around there anymore, I grew up in that area. I had a circle of friends who were just like me. They went to school. They did their thing after school, normal kid stuff. Over time, a lot of those people kind of gave up. We're talking about my specific circle of friends that like gave up and had turned to selling drugs. I could walk into a couple of my friends' houses back, my original hometown. There'll be like brand new tires sitting in their living room, not on their car. They quote unquote found some tires that they're going to pawn off. a lot of them are heavy into drugs, that are heavy into manufacturing and selling drugs. And so when I was originally venting about that idea that our hometown had become this infestation of crime, I used the phrase when I was talking to you, I said that people back home have universally developed these illegal hustlers or hustles. And you had said, well, you say universal, but really that's your circle of friends. And that's why I pointed that out to begin with. Because when I go back to that hometown now, I don't see that as my circle of friends having turned to crime. I say everybody in that town is a fucking criminal. And it drives me crazy. That's the mindset I got into. I was around these specific people so much and saw them turn to the dark side over time that I just see that whole town as this infestation of crime and drug use. So I wonder if you start polling Christians and they have a higher percentage of their group that thinks that it's a no effort sort of deal. I wonder if it's because those communities in those churches deal directly with things like giving out food to the poor and watching some of the poor people come in and seeing their attitudes and seeing the people who do, in fact, have those drug problems but are still needing food. I wonder if the direct contact with that is one of the reasons why those numbers are skewed like that, because it was that case with me. Because of the direct contact I had with my friends that turned to crime and drugs, I now view that entire town as like this redneck mafia area.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. It also varies, I feel like, how much different Christians, or at least, and when we say Christians, we mean people who identify as Christian in surveys like the one that Jason, you cited from the Washington Post, and the numbers on that: 46% of all Christians said that a lack of effort is generally to blame for a person's poverty, compared with 29% of all non-Christians. But when we say Christians, I also wonder how much of that kind of social work and that kind of outreach and donational work they're doing, because it varies with everybody. Like where I grew up around Chicago, it's a relatively wealthy collar county. It's also a heavily conservative, heavily Christian. I feel like when those people do social work, if they do it, they're maybe finding poverty closer to Chicago itself or further out. I don't know. But in other cases, maybe they're not really coming into contact with actual poor people. Like maybe the distrust in their case is just coming from attitudes and what they've heard.
Well, just speaking anecdotally, and I, you know, again, obviously John and I are from the same small town. We went to school together. You ran into a lot of that. I ran into a lot of that there, because among the ones who are working, if they're in like the same trailer park as someone who is collecting a disability check, and the people who are collecting disability checks were the ones they hated the most, because there was always, there's like a stereotype of the guy who got hurt at work 20 years ago and has been claiming his back is out for 20 years since and collecting some sort of a disability check for 20 years since, just drinks full time. And there's that stereotype that you know, the person's just lying about it or exaggerating about it, or they basically just use that accident as a get out of work for free card. And the idea that, you know, I'm working as a nurse sometimes on my feet for 36 straight hours, and I'm coming home to the same trailer park as this guy who just sits on his porch and drinks full time, I think that is its own kind of hatred. Now, a lot of it is just as misguided, because you don't know that person's circumstances. And again, it's easy to not see all of the bad things happening in that person's life, like the fact that they can't seek medical care or dental care, or, you know, for a lot of things, or that they have no, you know, that someday, the, you know, before age 50, somebody's just going to find this person dead on their kitchen floor. Like, because a lot of the pundits we talk about, the right-wing pundits that kind of really go in on the idea that people on welfare are buying steak and lobster with their food stamps or whatever, the audiences of those broadcasts are low-income people. It's low-income whites. And so that angry nurse living in a trailer is listening to Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh every day and hearing her neighbor being demonized, and kind of can look across the yard and say, yeah, that lucky bastard gets to sleep until noon every day. So that pervasive idea that the poor are the ones who are really getting away with murder in our society, and they're taking advantage of the rest of us, and that all of society's benefits are going to them, it reaches even that person who's living 10 feet away. I saw that in my own home. I saw it among my circle of friends in school. I heard it among my teachers at school. Like, this was a very deep red conservative, cut the food stamps, cut welfare county, and in a county and in a part of the state that was heavily subsidized by those benefits.
In my experience, there's a more personal psychology that goes with it. So, like, even if you take away the news, even if you take away the talking points of the poor do this and this person's sitting around doing that, you spend your entire childhood and having people look down on you and give you those looks, and you have the school lunch program thing that I was talking about earlier. Yeah. You spend a lot of your time feeling humiliated, and at some point you look for someone to humiliate. There's no one to look down on because you're the guy at the bottom of the ladder. And so when you find somebody who you can twist their story into sounding like they're taking advantage of the system, or God forbid you find someone who actually is taking advantage of the system, you finally have somebody that you can look down on, and it kind of makes yourself feel better. It's like the nerds we grew up with who got beat up for liking Dungeons and Dragons, and then when the internet came out, they're so good verbally that they're the ones throwing the proverbial stones. Like, they're annihilating jocks. It's their vengeance time. It may not be that spiteful, but there's a feeling of relief you get when you can say, yeah, my life has been pretty shitty so far. My job sucks and I get humiliated all the time, but goddamn, I'm not as bad as this person.
It's a lot of the same reason why racism is so pervasive in poor communities. You know, the one perspective you so rarely hear in that small town is like, hey, we here in this small town and the people, you know, in the inner city, like, hey, we're both victims of globalization, or, you know, the factories moving away, or whatever, you know, the fact that you can't get a job without a college degree. Like, they don't see themselves as being in the same boat. I think that they've been trained so that both of them being in sort of that same category and being in proximity, they've been trained to hate each other, because I think it is to some people's advantage that they hate each other a little bit.
Right. It's sort of like breaking up the, I guess you'd call it, class consciousness of poorer people. Like, have them go after each other instead of like working together and trying to raise everybody's lot. Yeah.
Support for today's show comes from ZipRecruiter. And what a perfect sponsor. We're talking all about people trying to find a way forward in this economy. And one company making that easier is ZipRecruiter, because they know that people are hiring. No matter how big your business, no matter what your needs might be, you need the right people. And that's what can really make all the difference. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way to work that out. So they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs, and right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Here's the info. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/cracked. That is ZipRecruiter.com/cracked. ZipRecruiter.com/cracked. That gets you in. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Well, hey there, adult fans of the Cracked Podcast. Are you looking to spice things up in the bedroom? Have you been fantasizing about surprising your lover with an adventurous new toy or adult movie? Well, here's an offer you won't be able to resist. Go to adamandeve.com, and for a limited time only, you adults, you'll get 50% off just about any item. But that's not all. When you select your one item at 50% off, you'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs for a little inspiration, plus a free extra gift so sensual we can't even mention it. They won't let me. Can't do it. And to top it all off, they will even throw in free shipping on your entire order. They're not kidding. It ships free. You win. So check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Get 50% off one item, plus 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping when you enter the offer code CRACKED at checkout. That's the magic word. Just use offer code CRACKED at adamandeve.com. That's CRACKED, C-R-A-C-K-E-D, at adamandeve.com.
One thread we kind of got at a little bit earlier is that idea that being poor, or at least feeling poor, it's relative. It's all based on the other people around you and how they're doing. Like even that woman coming home from her nursing shift to the trailer park does feel, if she's not richer yet, she ought to be richer than this other person in another trailer who did not work those shifts. And it seems like across studies and across people looking at it, our idea of who is even poor at all is very relative. It's based on us looking at each other and seeing, oh, okay, this person and that person have that, so therefore I should feel good or bad. There's a professor at UNC, his name's Keith Payne, and he has a book called The Broken Ladder about inequality. And for one thing, he grew up on free lunch, like we've talked about, and he said that was the first time he felt poor, was when he realized that his lunch was free and most other kids was not. And he writes about how when he had that realization, his family's wealth didn't change, his situation didn't change. All that changed was mentally who he was and sort of the ecosystem of the other kids. And he said it suddenly shut him up in class and redirected his future. And then in the book goes on into a lot of different studies that they've done with people and also with toddlers, and they've even done studies with monkeys. But they've found that anytime there's a system presented to people and it seems to be unequal, whoever's on the bottom of it behaves completely differently. And it doesn't matter if they came in with tremendous wealth or not. And this is sort of a broad percentage because this is social science, but he says that material wealth is about 20% of how people perceive their actual wealth and status. The rest of it is just how they feel about other people around them and about the system around them. It seems like the way we hate on poor people as a society is really, really worsening a poverty that maybe would otherwise be manageable. Obviously, full-on homelessness or hunger is not manageable no matter how you frame your brain, but maybe we could do a lot for people if we just stopped punishing them and constantly indicating to them that they ought to feel terrible.
Jason, I don't know if I ever told you this or not. I may have. The first time I felt like I had gone up in status is when I was able to have paper towels in my kitchen when you came over. And this is just a tiny bit of backstory is Jason would come over for, like, say, Thanksgiving or whatever. And before we ate, he'd wash his hands to get the filth of my apartment off of his body. And then he would look around the kitchen and say, "Where's your paper towels?" But at that point, I was coming off of just a really terrible job. And the idea of buying paper towels was ridiculous. It was a waste of money, especially when I've got perfectly fine dish towels right there. And when we're done, you just wash them and put them back. It was baffling to him because he had always had paper towels. When I went up in financial status and I started stocking paper towels all the time, and then I got to the point to where I couldn't imagine not having paper towels in my kitchen, that's when I stepped back and said, "You finally made it. You're finally middle class, baby." Such a small thing like that fascinates me, though, because you never would think about that in a million years. If you've grown up middle class or even on the upper end of the poverty spectrum, paper towels are just paper towels. But when you look at them when you're at the store and you're in a certain level of poverty and it makes you laugh, the idea of buying those paper towels, when they become a staple of your everyday life, that's such a weird change that you don't think about.
Well, right. And the fact that when we were growing up together, you thought of me as like your wealthier friend. where, right. you know, like we almost had our home repossessed by a bank at one point. And like the first time, like I left the town and someone had mentioned going to a Chinese restaurant. And I was like, you have a restaurant from China? how do we dress? Do I have to take a class on how to use chopsticks? Like, I thought it was the fanciest thing in the world. So whereas back in the town, like you know, then he's coming to my house and is like, you have towels you throw in the trash? Like, you have a box that spits out cold air in the summertime versus just sitting there in your own sweat? This is at the heart of it, right? Because the whole issue is there is a pervasive idea in America that among all religions, among all mindsets, about 40% of the people believe, which is that it's too easy to be poor in America. That we're not making the poor hurt enough, and that's not motivating them to go out and work. It's not motivating them to improve, because if you could just sit at home and make money and, you know, play video games all day, why wouldn't you? All of polite society is built around the idea of putting social pressure on people to do things, right? We're all, at least two of us, are wearing pants because there's a social pressure on leaving your house without pants, right? And so we generally, the reason society functions, the reason somebody doesn't just walk into your house and then rub their dick on your new television is that they grew up, and even if there's no written rules, right, we enforce these rules among each other. We make each other conform through ridicule, through, you know, ostracizing people, whatever. So the premise is, and no one ever speaks this out loud, really, it's just an assumption that it's too easy to be poor. We're just not applying enough social pressure on the people at the bottom rung of the ladder. That is as sharp a divide in this country between the people who believe that and the people who don't believe that as really anything, as abortion, as guns, any of those subjects you think of as like as wedge issues. The attitude toward are the poor to blame for being poor and are we not, is it too easy to be poor? That's as defining a trait for your ideology as almost anything.
Well, you mentioned ridicule as a tool, and I've seen that a lot. I'll give you an example of how you can do it without it, and that is simply not giving poor people the information to begin with, which is like we had an economics class in high school, and they're giving you the basics on how to budget through the week. So they're teaching you basic things like here's how to balance your checkbook, here's how to manage your credit card, and there is no part of that class that is tailored to poor people. In our town, the majority of that class, let's not even go that far. Let's say half the class is going to be in poverty if they remain in that town after graduation. The idea to those people that they could even get a credit card is beyond laughable. I got my first credit card last year. I'll be 44 this month. We didn't have a checking account growing up because that means you have to have money, a pool of money that you're not spending that just stays in the bank. And that idea is laughable. So there's nothing that teaches you how to get on the programs to begin with. There's nothing that says, here's how to budget groceries for the week when you have $20 to spend. The furthest we ever got into that lesson was, hey, instead of buying brand name jeans, let's buy generic jeans. Like, that's as far as that lesson went. But as far as a class that taught you how to deal with money when you don't have money, it doesn't exist. When somebody tells me back then, here's how to manage your credit card debt, they might as well have been teaching me, here's how to have sex with your Porsche. It's just such a random, weird idea.
Well, I don't feel like it's that weird. We're not here to kink shame people.
Yeah, Porsches are attractive. I mean, you know, what are you going to do?
But in that class that we probably had together, one of the lessons we had for a week was on investing. Because I remember them sharing like the tip, when the prime rate is high, stocks will die. That high interest rates are bad for investment. And it's like we're sitting there, one, we're like 16 years old, but it's like, half these people don't have like checking accounts. Like, you're giving us advice on how to, you know, it's like, well, now be careful about putting all your money into commodities. You know, you hear a lot of talk of gold's a good investment, but in reality, traditionally, gold has not gone up that much in times of economic security. It's like, man, this is intended for a different audience. And, you know, it's the same thing. How many websites are there, you know, or newspaper sections of magazines that are about like finance? You know, it's all about investing. It's all about, you know, where to put your money versus just publications that are about like what you're talking about, just budget, you know, that's just the basics. Like, here's which credit cards will actually won't screw you over. Here's how you can avoid late fees, you know, or here's how you can trick Comcast into giving you a free month of service despite threatening to cancel, like stuff that we now think of as like life hacker stuff. I wasn't getting that. I we had a course on how to fill out a tax form, things like that. But, you know, I went away to college. First thing I ran into was that they had a stand, like a table where they were giving away free t-shirts if you applied for their credit card. I had a long line around the block of college kids getting a credit card. And it's like, up to that point, I had never had, you know, and maybe today they're better about doing that, but I had never had a course on, you know, look, here's how interest rates work. Here's, you know, how the late fees work and over the limit fees and all that crap. And here's the trap you're going to get into with credit. Like John, when in your life did you learn what a 401k was and what it did?
I would have probably been in my late 20s, early 30s.
I understood the general principle of saving for retirement and like, put a percentage of it. But actually what it does or how it functions, I feel like I'm like, I don't want to say I'm still picking that up, but there's probably wrinkles I don't know yet. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it was 3 years ago.
The most worthless lesson I've ever gotten in my life, even outside of that economic class, but it just so happened to be in that class, was what type of suit to wear to an interview. And I have never in my life applied for a job or been to an interview that required a suit. In fact, the types of jobs that I've had over the years had been ones where if you showed up in the suit, they would think that you were mentally unstable. Like, they would laugh you out of the interview. Whenever I got hired full time with Cracked, that was online. That was a thing that I worked my way into, but I didn't show up to an office and put on a suit and have an interview and all that. But all the things were like, you know, I'm going to work the truck wash. I'm going to work a hotel. Unless you're like an executive in a bank who starts at the bottom and works your way up, that's the only situation in a small town like this where you would even have to do that. But in that economics class, the lesson that we needed that we didn't get was, you've gone a year without a job. Here's how to make yourself appear hireable. That doesn't exist in there, but that would be so useful to have.
Even in a community of like relative wealth, like I feel like when I was in high school, there was a class about personal finance and we learned some things about it. But I don't think it covered stuff that like, say, the parents of my classmates were going through, like, hey, here's what to do when you've taken a second mortgage and unwisely and now you've got that. You know, that never came up. It was all just stuff like, here's how to balance a checkbook. You fill out the ledger with X, Y, and Z. And it was like very basic and very not disaster or crisis or even just issue oriented.
Right. It's third grade math. It's they were teaching you how to add and subtract again.
It was just with like dollar signs now. Like, that was it. Yeah.
Back in the day when you had paper checks and teaching you how to fill out a check register, but not teaching you, oh, by the way, if you write a check and you forget to write it down on the register thing and that puts you over the limit, your bank is going to start charging you $35 a day in overdraft fees until you get paid again. And then when you deposit that paycheck, the bank is going to seize the entire paycheck in overdraft fees. That's a lesson I never got. That's a lesson most of us had to learn when it happened. In theory, yes, it's your own fault. all of this, you could make the argument it's your own fault, but you have so little margin for error. And today, I forget about stuff all the time. And it's fine because I have that margin for error. I am not more responsible with my money than I was at age when I was 20 years old. But it now doesn't matter because I have more I have more room to fail. And that is the heart of the misunderstanding in most cases, because you can say, well, that able-bodied guy, if he really wanted to, or even the person that's mildly disabled. So you got chronic back pain. There's jobs you can do sitting down. There's jobs you can do that are just on the phone. You know, surely there's something you can do. And so, yeah, in theory, if you got up every morning and spent all day pounding the pavement, looking for work, willing to put yourself through enough physical pain, willing to do that, yeah, you probably could eventually land something. But you're asking that person to expend an amount of energy and to maintain a certain attitude in the face of adversity that you yourself have never had to do, and that you yourself in the same circumstances would not hold up to. So when you see somebody doing something that is objectively self-destructive, lots of the poor do drink a lot. A lot of their money does go to alcohol or to drugs or to generally things that are, you know, unhealthy or counterproductive. Yes, you could sit there and say, well, you know, if all of the money he spent on alcohol, if he had invested that money in Bitcoin, he'd be a millionaire today. That technically is true. The idea that this is not a robot and that this is in fact a human being that has urges and moods and things that they are trying to medicate, and they have emotions and things that they're trying to manage, it's easy to dismiss that in other people, even though we would never do it to ourselves.
Where it gets dangerous, I think, is when we take the extreme cases, the ones that have the most clickable headlines, and we hold that up as the standard. You see it all the time when politicians are speaking. So back in the late 70s, early 80s, Ronald Reagan's big thing was he got on this kick about the welfare queen. And the welfare queen was somebody he held up as like a staple of how people manipulate the welfare system. She was showing up to pick up her checks in a Cadillac and was like loaded with jewelry, fancy clothes. And she had scammed the U.S. government out of like $8,000. That's what she eventually got arrested for, was $8,000. He was so on to this topic and kept pushing it as this is, you know, this is how broken this system is that this woman can do that. He actually devoted a section of his weekly radio show to updating the welfare queen story. So years later, after all this passes, she eventually ends up getting busted for, you know, $8,000 worth of welfare fraud, does some time in prison, and then once she gets out, she disappears. Years later, we find out she was way, way, way worse than we ever thought. She had been involved in murder, child trafficking. She had like 80 identities. She was just a terrible, terrible con artist. And she was married to several men at the same time. And she was so good at changing her identity and her looks that the men did not know. So during these investigations, years after the fact, we find out that she was going to be charged with murder. They had evidence that she was involved in like this really notorious murder in, I think it was Chicago. They decided to not pursue the murder charge because they were afraid it was going to distract from the welfare charges. Let that sink in for a second. They dropped a murder charge that they had evidence on in order to pursue the welfare charges of $8,000. That was how important that was. That's how that narrative got so huge, because the story attached to it became such a big deal in political circles and news circles. It was unfathomable that somebody could screw us that easily. And it's like, now let's let the murder charge, you know, just fall off a little bit because we're so close to busting her on welfare stuff.
Right. Yeah. Because again, her role in serving as evidence that the poor don't need our help was more important. Like, ultimately, that position as the scapegoat to represent all of the poor to middle America, because, again, the message has to be, who has stolen the money out of the system? The poor.
Right.
Whose fault is it that society doesn't work the way it's supposed to? Well, clearly, it's that group at the bottom who has no access to the halls of power in Washington, the people who have no lobbyists speaking on their behalf. They have no ability to donate to presidential campaigns or politician campaigns. They have no ability to run for office because that costs millions of dollars. They have basically no political or social or economic pull whatsoever. But somehow they're the ones who have steered the car into the ditch. Somehow they did it. Which is almost inspirational if you think about it, that they were right. able to steer the entire direction of the country and the entire monetary policy and globalization and the jobs and manufacturing jobs. That's why the manufacturing jobs went away. Our potential factory workers were simply too lazy. So they had to move the job. They had to move the factory to China. It's we were too busy staying at home and playing video games. It's a convenient narrative for someone. But by the way, there's a series of numbers that we very briefly touched on, because we do have people listening who are still pretty sure that there may be some disabled and sick people who are poor, but most of the poor could do better if they wanted to, because that poll from earlier, the sentiment was about 40% of Americans believe that the poor are generally to blame for their own problems. Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, I realize that to some degree this is totally unknowable, like everyone's life is complex, but just to be clear, about a third of the poor in America are actual children. So right away, again, unless you're going with the children should be working as janitors thing, a third of them, they were born into poverty and they didn't ask for it, you know, unless there's some opportunity prior to birth in heaven where, you know, you're put through some test and the punishment for failing is you're forced to be born into a poor neighborhood. And then another 11% are elderly, which, again, I guess in theory they could work, but between the children and the elderly, you're knocking 40%, 41% off the board, around 41, 42%. Of the remaining 60%, about 20% of those are disabled. So of the able-bodied, working-aged people, that's only about half of the poor in America right there. So regardless of trying to look into their motives or whatever, of the sheer number of people who count as being in poverty, half of them are working age and able-bodied. Mm-hmm. Of those, about 40% of them have jobs. They just don't make enough money. So the premise that in general poor people are poor because they've made bad choices or whatever, just demographically, it's difficult to defend that idea. And if you want to say, well, yeah, but the children don't count because we're only referring to their parents, that's irrelevant, because when it comes time to talk about things like food stamps, Medicaid, the money we're spending on the poor, that's who we're talking about. So if your theory is we should cut benefits because the poor are lazy, you're cutting benefits to the children, you know, because you're saying their parents made bad choices. And then if your response is, well, then the government should stop certain people from having children, now you're getting into an area that I'm very confident you do not actually want to get into, where you're a small government conservative who also wants the government to have the power to take away the ability to have children from certain people. Like, I think you may have steered yourself into a dark wooded place that you will quickly find you're lost and cannot come back from.
Yeah, but seriously, if those 9% that's left over would just get off their asses and do something, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Look, those people exist because we've known them. If you go out looking for your examples of poor people, not even specific individuals that seem to have put themselves in that situation, but rather situations where they could have done better, where they're not spending their money the right way. Poor people, for example, play the lottery. The lottery is basically a tax on poor people based on hope, selling them the idea that this is a way out. And so you see somebody in line buying, you know, they're at the convenience store, you know for a fact they're on food stamps, and they're sitting there buying energy drinks and lotto tickets and cigarettes, and you roll your eyes like, well, there goes my paycheck, there goes my hard-earned money to buy this idiot cigarettes and lotto tickets. Only seeing the results of those behaviors and not seeing where those behaviors come from, like what it is they're adapting to, and the things that you, the habits you pick up growing up, and the fact that once you do start smoking, that the things that are available to you to help you quit cost money, even among other people living in that town. Like you find yourself, I can hear this among even my own family. Like they'll notice somebody paying for their groceries with food stamps and then like carefully scrutinizing what they've got in their cart. If you want to find an example that you can look at that will let you dismiss yourself from any responsibility to help them, like that, why should I have to help this person? They're just going to waste the money on cigarettes. You can find it if you want. And maybe that's part of the problem, but it requires you to hold these people to a standard you would never hold yourself to.
And also, it seems like it's getting the cause of their decisions or behavior backwards. And that, when I mentioned Keith Payne before, that's one of the central things he's found in his research and in other people's studies, that it's not that poor people are some kind of different group from the rest of us that just loves risk. It's that they have been made poor by their circumstances or by the system around them. And then because of that, they operate in a more risky way because they see the world as a space where, why would I sock away a few dollars here and there if I'm just going to lose it all to the system and to how things work? There's one study he pulls from. It's by Canadian psychologists who took a group of people and told them about something called the Normative Discretionary Income Index and ranked them based on it. And it was all made up. It was all just a fictitious thing that claimed to be about how wealthy they were relative to other people. And then after they ranked people in this fake thing, they gave them $20 and said the people could keep the $20 or gamble it on a computer card game. And anyone who had been ranked low on the scale was substantially more likely to gamble. It was like, well, if I'm in the hole, if I'm behind compared to the rest of society, I might as well just go for it. I might as well just get essentially a lottery ticket from this scientist. They've done also another study with preschoolers where, and these are people who haven't been taught about the economy or anything, but they've taken groups of preschoolers and had the preschoolers clean up a room they played in. And then they give the preschoolers unequal amounts of stickers for their effort. So regardless of who did what and picked up what, some of the kids get way more stickers than the other kids. And then as soon as they do that, the next time around when they need the room cleaned, all the preschoolers are just much less likely to get into it and actually pick up anything because they feel that the sticker system is rigged. It's in us from an incredibly early state to kind of shut down and stop acting rationally and squared away when the system doesn't seem to be something that works for us. And I think basically all poor people are just us plus that feeling about the world. It's not like there's some kind of different species or something that we should be looking down on.
I really want to do that sticker thing as a hobby now. That sounds like so much fun.
You've written articles on this subject about like habits that you pick up, like counterproductive habits you pick up growing up poor. And there were a couple that I would like you to touch on. One was about like how you treat, like when you get sudden money, like windfall money.
Windfall money for the poor always comes down to tax returns. And so whereas most of the world does their taxes in April, they wait till the last minute. A lot of the poor do it the second you get your tax forms back, and because you can get that money right away. So when you get a windfall check like that and you're used to your bank account hovering around a tight balance of zero, and you suddenly get this big a couple thousand dollars back from taxes if you have kids, and you're scared into spending it immediately. So you look around your house and you say, this couch has been destroyed for 6 months. I have to replace it. So you wait for your taxes, you buy a brand new couch, or that's when you buy a computer upgrade or you're a brand new TV or whatever. Because if not, what happens is you put that money in the bank and you watch it slow, or not even slowly trickle away, you watch it quickly trickle away to bills, to debts. So you find that anytime you get a burst of money, it has to be spent right now. Once you've trained yourself to do that, even when you get out of poverty, you find yourself doing it for a while because you've never learned how to use money as a tool. Like middle class and upper class kind of view money, not consciously, but view money the same way you'd view a hammer. This is the tool that I use to do these things and to keep this house. And with the poor, money is an emergency all the fucking time. So you get a windfall and you have to spend it right now. Food is kind of the opposite. Food you get and hoard away, because eating fresh foods, eating fresh fruits and vegetables and buying fresh meat and making a meal from scratch is expensive, really expensive compared to what you'd pay for a trip to McDonald's or just frozen food in the frozen section. A couple bucks and there's a whole meal. All you have to do is either stick it in the oven or nuke it in the microwave. And a couple minutes later, there's your entire meal. And it costs you like $2-3 to get hamburger and to get two sides or whatever. You're going to triple, quadruple that amount of money. So what you do is you stock up on frozen foods. And those frozen foods are always cheap, processed, really bad for your health type of food, so that you can get like 1500 calories in a single meal. And you put those in the freezer because they last forever. They're quick to make. And it prevents you from having to take trips to the store every 2 or 3 days because the fresh food goes bad. Obviously, if you don't eat it right away, it's going to go bad. And if you eat it right away, it's gone. So now you're taking more trips to the store. When you're on that level of poverty that we grew up in, that gas money just to get to the store and back is important. It's needed. And taking multiple trips is just seen as a waste. But then you go more into the time factor, which is if you're a working class poor, you have one, maybe two, maybe three jobs, and every minute in your day counts. You get home from your second job or your third job, you're exhausted. There's no time to go to the store. You don't want to stand in front of the oven or the stove for the next 20 minutes making something. All that stuff balls together, and it turns out the easiest solution is let's go through the freezer section and stock my freezer up. You also get paid in food stamps, which come monthly. Now it's done on like a card system, but the idea is still the same. Here's a certain amount of money you get for the entire month. And you find yourself buying a bunch of food that can last for a long time and storing it. And then at the end of the month, if there's anything left over on that card, you spend it right away before that money evaporates off of there. Because at the end of the month, it just resets and you get the same amount of money again. If they find out over time you're not spending all that money, they're going to give you less food stamps because you don't need that much. Everything is a balance between what money do I have? What money am I going to have after this month? Well, I even went further and talked about the fact that because these frozen foods are so bad for you, you get into an obesity problem because it's just straight as calories and fat and salts and sugars and all that going into your system. Well, then you set up a situation where everybody's looking from the outside in and saying, well, she's eating well. look at that fat ass. Like, the, she definitely doesn't have a problem with food because she weighs, you know, 260 or whatever. It's like, no, the only thing she's been shoveling into her body has been the stuff she's got access to.
There are lots of, like, pitfalls and cliffs set up in the system, like we mentioned earlier, where, for instance, something like unemployment benefits, where people are scared to death to take short-term, like, seasonal work. Because, say, somebody's got a construction job, they're going to pay you $500 to come do some work, that, but that job's only last 2 weeks. It doesn't matter. You're, if you have that income, you get kicked off your benefits, and you have to reapply from scratch and try to get back on, even though you knew. So it's just easier to not take it. And again, it's not that you're lazy, necessarily. It's that you have people you're trying to feed. You have children. So it's not a smart long-term decision. Not everybody in the situation lives in a small town, but this was our experience. And like with, like, John, you went through a lot of different phases, like things you wanted to try to do. You had tried to go to college at one point. Like, you went through a lot of plans to try to get out of your situation. One of them was, you had talked about going into teaching at one point, because it was something you would naturally be good at. You're a good public speaker. You're good with people. You're good at explaining, because you now, that was, is your job, is explaining concepts to people. You had a talent for math, so you thought about being a math teacher. But we had a conversation one day where you explained to me that there was one math teacher job in town. And that by pursuing right. that degree, you were basically waiting for one person to retire or die, and then have to hope that not a single other person wanted that job. I bring this up because what sounds like a very sensible course of action, get an education, learn to do something that you're good at, actually would have been insane, because you have now student loans, and it's like, well, okay, in order to find a job, I'm going to have to be willing to not only move out of town, but maybe move 4 hours away, maybe move out of state, maybe, you know. And so it's like, do you have the money to move? No, you do not, because you, unlike the people whose parents can help them, you are not in that situation. You do not have parents who could loan you the money to even, like, help you pay for a moving van or help you put down first month's rent on a place in the destination city. You're leaving all of your support network behind. Anybody who could help you babysit, anybody that could, is currently, you know, everyone has a network of support, somebody who will fix your car for free, somebody who, you know, maybe you know somebody that can do plumbing, and if you get a leak and you can't call a plumber, maybe they can fix your plumbing for free. People who can do favors for you, you're leaving it all behind. You're now, you know, surrounded by strangers with college loan debt in a new city, trying to make it work. It can happen, but that course of action is just slightly less plausible than if you had pursued your other ideas to play in the NBA, or we talked about moving away and doing stand-up comedy, you know, or we tried to, you know, we wrote movie scripts and thought, well, maybe we could be screenwriters. Those things that now looking back were like the fantasies of poor people who are too dumb to know how the world works. That was not measurably dumber than trying to pursue this other avenue, like in terms of risk and in terms of taking on the debt and going to college and knowing you're living in a town where there's no job and you have to move away from family. What seemed like objectively stupid choices, it's like, well, is it dumber to take a minimum wage job working at a fast food restaurant? This adds nothing to my resume, right? There's no room for advancement. There's one manager. Again, unless that manager dies, then no, I'm not going to move up to manager. It doesn't make enough money to support me. I'm too exhausted to take classes or do whatever. Like, what? Why is that any smarter of a move than playing the lottery, than saying, you know what, for the amount of money I've got, spending this money on weed actually brings me dollar for dollar more happiness than anything else I can spend it on. Like, it's almost like questioning the choices of somebody that jumped out of a burning building from the fifth floor, and you're like, well, how did he think he was going to survive that fall? It's like, well, he didn't, but until you're in the burning building, in that moment, yeah, that was his best chance. And that's the thing, is it people who find happiness in doing all sorts of destructive things and drinking or in spending all their time at bars, or they've put all their hopes in trying to start a country music band in their garage, and you like rolling your eyes like, oh God, this person's going to be on welfare forever. It's like, man, you got to understand that's done in the context of all of their choices are bad.
And as we look at like what can be done, like how can we convince Americans to care about their fellow Americans who are down on their luck? Is it just getting to people to understand that kind of thing? Like, is it just an empathy gap that we need to find some way to fill? Like, that seems like a doable thing. We've been doing it today, right now. How about us? But not to pat ourselves on the back. Like, are there other ways we can fill this gap and just help people understand? Or maybe people don't want to understand. I don't know.
I think that we look towards finding a blanket fix because we like to believe there's one out there. I'm not sure I believe that, because I know how I got out of it through my individual experience, and none of that was planned. Like, when people ask Jason, how do you get a book published? The story starts with, okay, first start a website and work for no money for 15 years. And then it goes on. There's all these domino effects that get you out of it. I had to know the right people. I had to have the right skills. I had to hone my skills to where I thought they were great, and then realize I had a long way to go after that. There's so many things that happened to get me out of it. I'm not entirely sure that there is a blanket fix for that, for like poverty in general, or and we can say that it's going to require a lot of empathy from people, but man, that's changing not just a thought pattern, that's changing the way you behave and the way you truly think. That's like trying to change the direction of the capillaries in your skin. That shit is embedded.
Their self-worth is tied to the fact that they're not poor. People need to feel superior to somebody. I'm not even sure people actually hate the poor. I think they hate a straw man version of the poor that needs to exist.
Man.
Because that if that nurse is going to drag herself out of bed at 5 a.m. every morning and go to the hospital or go to the nursing home and clean up puke and crap for 18 straight hours, she has to know that if I wasn't doing this, I would hate myself because I couldn't tolerate, you know, living off of other people's generosity or charity or welfare. And the hatred of that shiftless neighbor, you know, collecting disability, that's what drives her to get to work. Lots of us motivate ourselves with something very similar. And I don't know, you know, and I keep hearing people say, well, in Europe, it's not like that. You know, they've got these socialist countries, or in Sweden or whatever, it's not like that. We right. support our fellow, you know, we have a socialist history. And it's like, okay, I'm not going to argue that with them. I'm reading the news. It feels like they have that attitude right up until a whole bunch of Muslim refugees show up. And suddenly it's like, well, you know, when I'm talking about like a safety net, I'm not talking about those people. Like, I see the same currents there where it's like, well, these people are going to come suck up all of our benefits. I know I sound like a conspiracy nut when I say that other people benefit from us like being at each other's throats, but I do feel like the system wants this. The system wants us blaming each other. In like being, you know, when a factory moves to China, being mad at China. You think they came at with guns and made the owners of the factory? You think they made this air conditioner company or car company move their factory to Mexico or whatever. Like, because I think what they did was they just figured out they could shave off another little sliver of profit by cutting pay to the workers. And that's why they moved. And so who are you mad at? It's like, yeah. Where's your anger directed? And I think that your anger is directed at the guy, the wino in the alley who's going to drink himself to death before he's 50 and is going to die having frozen to death on a sidewalk. I don't think that guy's the problem. I don't think that's the guy that screwed up your finances. I think it was somebody else.
I saw an interview once with the journalist Jorge Ramos, and the interviewer mentioned the idea of illegal immigrants, and Mr. Ramos stopped him and was like, no, hold on. There's no such thing as an illegal immigrant. No one is illegal as a human being. There are people hiring immigrants who come over illegally to do work. What we have is illegal companies. It's not the fault of the person who is offered a job and accepts it and crosses a border. There are other forces involved, and we get distracted from them.
Well, right. And I think, John, if when you were in, like, let's say you were 23 or 24 years old, if you had found out that in Canada they were offering, like, data entry jobs that pay, like, $150,000 a year, but in order to work the job, you would have to illegally cross the border, would you have done that? Or would your sense of patriotism...
I would have bought a brand new shovel to dig a tunnel under the border so I could get in. Like I would have done... I would have built my own plane to fly across the border to get there.
Yeah.
I don't think my patriotism would have come into play too much, though. I mean, I may have worn like an American flag shirt while I was doing it.
Folks, that is the episode for this week. My thanks to Jason Pargin and to John Cheese for, like, not just guesting, for sharing, for being insightful, and for observing that rule of mine about their penises and my flat screen TV. Keep my LCD away from your Pen 15. Come on. Keeps the picture sharp. Anyway, let's get into our food notes, where you will find tons of Jason and John's writing for Cracked. You'll also find a link to The Modern Rogue, where you can find John these days. And The Modern Rogue is seeking to give you the knowledge and skills to be the most interesting person in the room. But that's the idea of the site, and they publish a new article every weekday and a new video every Friday. So enjoy that. We're also linking to all kinds of info about the policies we talked about, the research we talked about. There's some amazing psychological studies going on in this field now. It's really great. And I'm also going to link you off to an SNL sketch. It's called Black Jeopardy. You might have seen it. It was one of their biggest sketches of last year. And there were various times on the episode where I brought up stuff like class consciousness. And hey, Alex, what's a footnote for that? Well, Marxism is sort of a hard sell. And I think this sketch is a more fun way into that idea, the idea of poor people recognizing that other poor people are in the same boat and are not necessarily their mortal enemy, who, as especially Jason really insightfully talked about on this episode, fellow poor people are probably not screwing you over with their no power, right? Anyway, Black Jeopardy, one of the funniest sketches SNL has done in a very, very long time. It's got Tom Hanks in it, if that appeals to you. It's going to be great. Just hit it up in the footnotes whenever you feel like it. What else is going on? We had a great live episode of the show this past weekend at UCB Sunset here in LA, and our next one in that same place, April 14th. Put that date on your calendar. We're going to have a whole new panel, whole new topic, and a real great time. And as far as this episode goes, our theme music is Chicago Falcon by the Budos Band. Our episode was engineered by Cody Scully and edited by Chris Souza. He in particular took out almost all of my coughing because I'm still kind of flu-y. I really, really appreciate it. If you love this episode, that's great. If you hated it, let me know about it on social media. That's right, social media, the space where every once in a while you come across a real version of a real person. Isn't that neat? You can find my Twitter account at Alex Schmitty. I'm also on the wider internet at my website, alexschmitty.com. And I'm happy to say we will be back next week with more Cracked Podcasts. So how about that? Talk to you then.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.